loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, a peaceful ship holding supplies and medicine bound for Gaza and the Palestinian people in Gaza has been hijacked by the Israeli military on the high seas, and the peace delegation on the ship has been taken to prison. Also, this weekend, Ahed Tamimi, the teenager who was held in jail for 8 months with her mother in Israel, has been released from custody. And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules, with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. Today, Chris walks us through the fallout of Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube's manipulation of what we can and do see on social media, and the recent revelations of the TSA's Quiet Skies program, where air marshals physically monitor specific flyers on commercial airplanes.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, President Trump said on Sunday that he was willing to push the government into a shutdown in September if Congress does not fund his border wall and change the immigration law. In a tweet, he blamed Democrats for problems in immigration policy and said he wants to end the visa lottery and the catch-and-release policy. Next, in a complete reversal of longstanding policy, U.S. diplomats met with Taliban leaders in Qatar a week ago without any Afghan government officials present. The talks reportedly were led by Alice Wells, the Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia, but neither the State Department nor the Taliban would comment. Then, voters in Zimbabwe go to the polls today to elect a president. This is the first time since the founding of the country in 1980 that Robert Mugabe will not be on the ballot. He was ousted in November by the current president and ZANU-PF party leader, Emmerson Mnangagwa. He and MDC alliance leader Nelson Chamisa are locked in a close race. And then, after locking up his chief rival, Cambodian strongman Hun Sen claimed a landslide victory in Cambodian elections over the weekend. Hun was re-elected to the position of Lord Prince and Supreme Defender. The United States, Australia, and several other countries condemned the election as a farce. And finally, we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, where we look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Today, we focus on the school-to-prison pipeline. And in other headlines, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort will be in court tomorrow in Virginia for the first day of his trial and the first time anyone indicted in the Mueller probe will be tried. The Mueller team's arguments and evidence will be closely watched for hints at the direction and future of the probe. Manafort is facing charges of bank and tax fraud, though these charges do not yet appear to relate in any way to election meddling. British Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt said in Beijing today that China has offered discussions about free trade opportunities with Britain after Brexit. Hunt also caused global controversy when he told Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi that his wife was Japanese, although she's actually Chinese. 4 million people are in jeopardy of losing their Indian citizenship in the northeastern state of Assam. The Indian government today published an initial draft of the National Register of Citizens, part of a controversial effort to expel undocumented Bangladeshi immigrants. Historical events, primarily the partition of India and Pakistan in 1947 and the secession of East Pakistan in 1971 to form Bangladesh, has led to a fluid situation in this region of the world relative to residence and citizenship. Talks aimed at reaching a peaceful solution to the war in Syria are underway in the Russian city of Sochi. The talks between the Syrian government and elements of the opposition are convened under the rubric of the Astana process, called by Turkey, Iran, and Russia. UN and Jordanian officials are also present in Sochi. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the Gaza flotilla. The Gaza flotilla ship Al Auda, carrying 13,000 euros worth of medical supplies to the people of Gaza and 22 activists from 12 countries, was intercepted by the Israeli Navy yesterday and forced to go to the port of Ashdod, where the activists are being detained and questioned. They will likely be expelled from Israel soon. Meanwhile, Ahed Tamimi has been released from prison after being there for 8 months for slapping an IDF, that is an Israeli soldier. We're joined from Houston, Texas by Colonel Ann Wright. She is a retired U.S. Army colonel and a former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Ann Wright resigned in principle and out of principle to protest the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and has become an anti-war activist. And we're joined from Washington, D.C. by Ariel Gold. Ariel is a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink, who has spent a great deal of time in the region. Welcome, Ariel and Ann Wright.
Good day.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Thank you. We've spoken with you numerous times about the flotilla, the attempt by the Israeli government to treat the flotilla bringing humanitarian supplies as really nothing less than a semi or full-blown terrorist operation that has had Israeli repression visited upon it time after time. Let's talk about the new developments.
Well, indeed, the Al Alda, one of our ships of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla for 2018, was hijacked. I wouldn't just say intercepted. It was hijacked yesterday about 1 in the afternoon Gaza time, 49 nautical miles off the shores of Gaza in international waters. It was hijacked. People were tasered on the boat. They were taken against their will to a place they did not want to go, which was Israel. They have been incarcerated, imprisoned in Givon prison, and are hopefully being visited today by consular officials. And I know that they have been visited by lawyers that we have retained in Israel. They will probably be deported from Israel, and the deportation is for 10 years. I know that well because I've been deported twice from Israel for being on previous flotillas. And the medical supplies that we have, though, we are demanding that the Israeli government immediately send the medical supplies, which are, as you mentioned, 13,000 euros worth of medical supplies, primarily sterile gauze and sutures, which were requested by the Medical Ministry of Health of Gaza. We demand that those be sent immediately as is required under international law for an occupying power to allow medical supplies to go into an occupied area.
Ariel, I read all of the English language Israeli press this morning, and it was universally hostile. One of the things that struck me was that no outlet made any mention whatsoever of humanitarian supplies or medical supplies or any such thing. All they said was that the peace activists were pro-terrorist, right? Pro-Hamas. What happens to all that humanitarian aid when a ship is intercepted and taken to Israel? Does it ever end up with the Palestinians?
Well, you know, what I've seen in some of the coverage is that the Israeli military has said they will, in fact, themselves deliver the aid. And this might be a question for you, whether you think that will actually come to be or it's they're just blowing hot air. And no surprise that there's so much hostility. Israel is just cracking down more and more, and we're just watching it go into overdrive on anybody who supports Palestinian rights and the ability of Palestinians to live at all.
Another thing, too, that surprised me was, first, that there is literally no coverage of the flotilla in the American press. And second, that there was almost no coverage in the Arab press. What happened to broader-based support for these efforts, especially from Arab countries?
Yes, the coverage of the arrival of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, or the one ship of the flotilla in Israel, having been hijacked in international waters, the arrival of it has caused a lot of news coverage in the Middle East, particularly through Al Jazeera, that has been doing live streaming. But there's been also a lot of coverage in Israel, some of it negative, but a lot of it even-handed. The Israeli press is very interested in the challenges that the international community does to the policies of the State of Israel on Palestinians. So it is in America that we get very, very little coverage. And in parts of Europe, of course, we get little coverage. But one of the important things is that people in Gaza know that we're coming, and that the media in Gaza is covering the progress of the flotilla. And in fact, there were press conferences night before last, and there were people that have been out on the beaches and at the docks in Gaza City to hopefully welcome another attempt to break that illegal Israeli blockade of Gaza.
So what happens next? This has become an annual event. Do you just keep going from here? Do you collect more humanitarian aid and medical supplies and then just plan for the next flotilla?
Well, the flotilla is not ended. We have another ship that's on the high seas right now. The Freedom ship is on the way. It should be arriving off the coast of Gaza in about 2 days, and we hope that it will be able to get into Gaza, because we are donating the ships of the flotilla. We're donating them to the fishers of Gaza, and we hope they can get through, not only with the medical supplies directly into Gaza, but also we want to leave those boats for the fishers of Gaza.
Ariel Gold, I want to touch back with you about a point that sort of has come up as a consequence of John's question to Anne Wright regarding media coverage. You have the U.S. government sort of a silent partner with the Israelis who are trying to suppress it. And even though it doesn't get a lot of press attention, maybe in the Western press, nonetheless, they treat it as an existential threat, because sort of inherently, foundationally within this movement is the reality that once it becomes a movement that gains worldwide attention and traction and endurance, it becomes perhaps the biggest problem for the Israeli state. It's not because it's an armed movement. On the contrary, it's a peaceful movement. It's because it reflects the potential of world public opinion shifting in a very dramatic way, as it shifted against the apartheid government in South Africa. And when you think back through history, whether it was, you know, Rosa Parks not giving up her seat in 1955, which she and other women in Montgomery had been doing for years without press attention and without success, but they just kept doing it and they kept doing it and they kept doing it. And then suddenly, like that time, the spark was lit, and all of this subterranean support that had been invisible suddenly became visible, and it became the dominant thing that changed the political reality. It kind of feels like that with to me, not just about the flotilla, but the flotilla is one of many instruments in this growing sort of incipient, embryonic global movement against this injustice. What do you think?
I think absolutely there is a growing global movement, and we're watching that time of change, and we're watching Israel become more and more terrified of it and more repressive. Just this, I think it was yesterday, we saw there's an Italian painter that was did a beautiful mural, yeah, of Ahed Tamimi on the separation wall in Bethlehem, and the painters were arrested and are now being deported for creating artwork. I mean, this is a situation that is just absurd, and we're watching it more and more. And I would say that Israel seems to think that by cracking down, by deporting artists, by blocking ships with humanitarian aid, by sending Palestinian children like Ahed Tamimi to prison, that they are somehow going to contain this growing movement for justice. But we're seeing quite the opposite, that their efforts are backfiring.
Ariel, I'd like to follow up on that, too. You mentioned Ahed Tamimi. We've covered her very sad case here on this show. She was just released from prison or jail, whichever one it was, over the weekend, along with her mother. Now, for the period that she was in jail for slapping an Israeli soldier, she's really become an international cause celeb, especially when it comes to human rights and Palestinian rights. What's next for Ahed Tamimi? She's got this wonderful soapbox now. What do you think she is preparing to do with it?
Well, I wouldn't say it's just a sad story. This is a story of inspiration, really, as well, and a story of a real victory Israel was hellbent on seeing Ahed Tamimi sentenced to up to a decade in prison, just throwing the book at her. But thanks to enormous groundswell of from the international community and from human rights organizations and so on, they had to cut a deal with her, giving her, which, you know, is a very long time when you're 17, but 8 months compared to years and up to a decade that she was facing is really a victory. And her family celebrated it as such at the time. Ahed gave a press conference yesterday in her village of Nabi Saleh with her mother. Her mother was imprisoned with her. This is a mother and daughter imprisonment, and her mother was released yesterday as well. So they gave a press conference, and Ahed spoke about what she had learned from prison about having patience and working with a group and time spent, really studying international law and humanitarian law. And she says that she'll be going forward with her studies and plans to go into law, and that the resistance doesn't stop. And we are looking at a people across Palestine and really across both the Arab world and the entire world who are inspired and motivated by her. And it's just been a tremendous growth for the movement. And again, I would say, you know, a real failed strategy from Israel.
We really should add exactly why she felt it was necessary to slap those soldiers that were in her driveway. It was because her brother had been incarcerated, her cousin had been murdered by them, and here were the soldiers coming back up into their driveway, and she had no earthly idea what they were going to be doing. That's a part of it that they forget to add into it. I'll also mention that young man that's being deported for putting a picture, a painting, a remarkable, beautiful picture on the apartheid wall, we met him in Naples 2 weeks ago because he painted a beautiful set of eyes on the bow of our boat, Al Alda, the eyes of Vittorio, who a young Italian man who had gone to Gaza on the very first boats that actually got into Gaza, and he stayed there many, many years. And his motto was stay human, and his eyes, and now the eyes of Gaza, looking at the Palestinians from the bow of our boat to Gaza.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures of the boat, and I encourage all of our listeners to go online and just, you know, type in the words Gaza Freedom Flotilla and the ship Al Auda, and look at those eyes on the bow of the ship. I mean, really, really, really dramatic. And now,
very.
And now that ship has been hijacked, as Anne Wright put it, hijacked by the Israeli authorities and taken into port, and all of its cargo, which includes humanitarian supplies to the people of Gaza, absconded with by the hijacking authorities, the Israeli government, paid for by American taxpayers, $4 billion a year or more than any other government and country in the world receives in terms of U.S. military and economic aid. I want to just restate for our audience who we're speaking with. We're joined from Houston by Anne Wright. She is a retired United States Army colonel and a former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan. She resigned in protest of the Bush-Cheney invasion of Iraq in 2003 and is today an anti-war organizer and activist. And we're also joined from Washington, D.C. by Ariel Gold, a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Bink, who has spent a great deal of time in the Middle East. Ariel Gold, let's talk about the words Al Auda. That's the name of the ship. Americans who are not of Arab ethnicity might not know what Al Auda means. Can you explain the term, the word, and what its significance is?
Al Auda means the return, and it's referring to the right of Palestinian refugees to return to the homes and lands that they've been expelled from. In 1948, when Israel established itself as a state, over 750,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from their lands and their homes inside what is now Israel. And in fact, around 70% of the population in Gaza are refugees from what is now Israel, and they're calling for their right, and this is UN Resolution 194, to return to their homes and lands. Since March 30th, Palestinians in Gaza have been engaging in weekly and sometimes daily nonviolent protests called the Great March of Return at the border fence that's really a prison fence, calling for the right to return as well as an end to the siege and basic human dignity. Israel has responded to this, you know, beautiful, it's really a beautiful movement with deadly force. I have nothing more to say than this. It's a war crime. Over 140 Palestinians in Gaza have been shot dead by snipers at these marches. Among them have been many children, have been journalists who were clearly marked as press, and medics. Just despicable. And yet the people of Gaza continue to hold these protests and continue to call on the world to help them realize their human rights and the implementation of international law. So I think it's so fitting that the boat this year was named Al-Auda, the return, because that's what's being called for.
Yes, and right, just again, because people who are not following this issue may not know, the Israeli government, which, you know, last week passed a law proclaiming itself to be a state for Jews, for Jewish people, even though 20% of the population is still non-Jewish. And when you think about the fact that Israel really has absolute control over the West Bank and Gaza, if you look at that entire area of historic Palestine, that would include what's called Israel proper since 1948, West Bank and Gaza, The majority population isn't Jewish. The majority population is, in fact, either a combination of Muslims and Christians. Jews represent a significant part of the population. But when we think of it that way, we're looking at a minority apartheid regime for the entire area, because there's not two states. There's one state. There's only one state that exercises control. And when you think about that, in this area, where it's been so critically important for Christianity, for Judaism, for Islam, I mean, all of the three major monotheistic religions and all of the peoples of the world who affiliate, not to mention the indigenous populations. And right now, and if a Jewish person who was born in Brooklyn wants to go to Israel, they have the right of return. But the 750,000 plus Palestinians who were expelled in 1948, and all of their descendants have absolutely no right of return, according to the Israeli government, even though they're granted that right by international law. I mean, it really is apartheid.
Indeed it is. And the whole issue of how a state determines what it is called, now the Jewish state of Israel, I mean, that's hijacking the location of the great religions of the world. Many of the great religions, three of the great religions of the world, have been hijacked by this rogue Israeli government. And people around the world are rightfully outraged. And for the security of the state of Israel, what they've done has not increased their security at all. In fact, it has jeopardized their national security by these apartheid laws and these you know, kind of isolationist things that they're doing to their own country. They think in for the preservation of it, but I think, in fact, it's more for the destruction of it, really, from within.
And there are two Israelis on the ship right now, two Israeli peace activists. Can you tell us a little bit about other Israelis who are supportive of the flotilla? We have Miko Pellet on this show a lot, and I know that he's a big supporter, but there have to be others, right?
Oh, indeed there are. In fact, in Tel Aviv tonight, there was a gathering of peace people and those that are supporting of the Palestinian cause. And one of our two Israelis that were on on the ship, Zohar Chamberlain Rakef, who was our boat leader. She was attended that, and then the other person, Yonatan Shapira, who is a former IDF soldier and who now is part of a group called Breaking the Silence of Israeli soldiers who no longer will do anything that the government says for them to do as far as oppression of the Palestinians. And they are both two brave people because they know what that the Israeli government will just, I mean, they go after them big time when they go on these flotillas, but they are willing to stand up to the Israeli government saying, you cannot continue to do to the Palestinians what you're doing. And we as Israeli citizens, by our presence on these boats, we draw attention to your illegal criminal acts against the Palestinians.
Ariel Gold, that's really, that's an inspiring message. You have people of all ethnicities, so-called races, religions, nationalities, saying, look, we all reject apartheid. We reject the kind of extreme, super narrow nationalism where people are actually granted rights or denied rights based on ethnic or religious identity. We reject that. When you put it in it, as you are, as the flotilla is, putting it in these kind of basic terms, the magnetic appeal of that is truly universal.
Absolutely. This is, as we've said before, this is a growing movement. This is a movement that is speaking out against family separation here in the U.S. and family separation in Palestine, where we see around 700 Palestinian children every year being arrested and detained by the Israeli military. This is a movement that is saying no more to a settler colonial project and to apartheid, to a brutal, brutal siege on Gaza. And we're at a time now where we all need to take action and where we have the real possibility for change.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Houston, Texas, by Ann Wright. Ann is a retired United States Army colonel and diplomat. She is a former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan, one of the very, very few who, out of principle, resigned in protest against the illegal Bush-Cheney war against the people of Iraq in 2003. She's since become an anti-war activist and is a longtime activist with the Gaza Flotilla Freedom Movement. And we've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Ariel Gold, a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. Ariel has spent a great deal of time in the Middle East and has done so much to advocate for justice for the Palestinian people right here in the United States. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules, with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa, and we're joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and the producer of this show. Welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Happy to be on again.
Chris, I want to start with you and with the news that at the end of the week last week, the share prices of Facebook and Twitter just looked like they were crashing. And it's not because there's any fundamental economic problem with either of these companies, although Twitter's had some challenges. It's a reaction to the invasion of privacy, really, that's been revealed over the last couple of months. Can you start by talking about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've got some windows open right now and I'm doing something I don't normally do and monitoring stock prices. but, you know, Facebook has just taken a nosedive since late last week, going from a little over 216 to right now it's at, 167. Twitter, similarly, going from, mid-40s to 32. And Google is taking a hit here as well, going from 1250 or so to 1222. Percentage-wise, these are all, significant hits for all of these companies. And for Google, it's, a result of some changes on YouTube. For Facebook, it's a number of things. So Facebook came out last week, and they had a conference call with investors where they basically, covered first of all, their market growth. And now there's actually a shrink in the number of people who are using Facebook, both in the U.S. and in Europe. And it seems to be the first time between late last year, the last quarter of last year, and the current quarter, where there has been a slight decline in the number of daily users of Facebook, both in the EU and the U.S., which is what they talked about on this conference call. Now, you realize that there's only so many people in the world. There are only so many people who have access to technology right now to get onto Facebook. And at some point, I would hope people would have seen that, you know, seen it in the future, that you can only have so many users, right? At the same time, you have other social networks that, you know, like Snapchat and Twitter and company that people are going to use. And so, you know, I think Facebook knew that, but of course, investors are only concerned with this quarter and the next quarter and maybe the one after that. They're not looking, you know, long term. The other thing, as you mentioned, that really plays into this is the privacy scandals that have been going on, not just Cambridge Analytica, but also Facebook's response and what they had to do because of a law in the EU called the GDPR. It's the General Data Protection Regulation. Again, GDPR that was passed a couple months ago in the European Union that really gives people a lot more control over what companies do with their data. And also gives people control over getting data from those companies, basically seeing what they know about you. So Facebook certainly has been impacted by that, and so have Twitter, Google, and all the other major social networks. So when the stocks really plunged, you know, significant numbers, over 20% between Wednesday and Friday, we saw the results of the outrage against all these privacy violations. Now, there are Facebook also announced that because of partly because of regulations, but also because of the outcry, they're going to be clamping down on what advertisers can see in terms of, and how they can target advertisements in terms of who's going to see their ads. One of the things is they're going to stop using something called partner categories globally. So they've already done this in the EU, particularly Germany, France, and the UK. So partner categories will mean that you can see in your industry, who's responding to ads from other companies in your industry.
Right. And that's really what it's about, isn't it? That it's all about the ads and revenue. I heard somebody last week make a point that was so simple and so true and important. And that is that pretty much everybody in the world who has access to Facebook and wants to be on it is on it. And there's really no more way to grow in terms of sheer numbers, because it's already something like 2.5 billion people are on Facebook. Now it's all about the ads. And to target the ads, they need to invade our privacy.
That's right. And there's also this big controversy, of course, about political ads, right? You know, I don't buy into the whole Russiagate situation. I think that there's a lot of questions about so-called Russian interference. And if you look at the stats that are commonly used about, you know, Russian companies, agencies buying ads, you know, they had very few views, and most of them were actually after the election. But I feel like that's been something that, you know, especially on this show, has been talked about significantly, and I encourage people to look into the truth on that more. But Facebook has also launched a new service. You can actually go in and search the ads. I tried it this morning. Turns out you have to log into Facebook to be able to see the ads that people have bought. So I can only imagine what they're going to be tracking about, you know, the fact that I just searched for ads in the Connecticut Attorney General race. They certainly have that information now that I, because I had to log into Facebook to do it. And it shows you, you know, all of the ads related to the term you put in. It shows you the ad performance, how many impressions it had, how much money was spent on that ad, the breakdown by gender and age, and where people saw that ad. So yes, that's giving a little more transparency. And it shows who paid for the ad too, which, you know, it could be a significant and important thing, especially when we're talking in the current political climate where corporations and super PACs have unlimited funds to spend on ads. So, you know, overall, I think it's a good thing that Facebook is doing this, but it's only a result of the public outcry over all of these privacy scandals.
You know, Chris, I think for a very large number of people, social media is the primary way that they get news about current events. Whether or not that's a good idea is another conversation, but I think it's true, right? And ever since I mean, ever since the 2016 election and perhaps before that, too, I mean, Facebook and other social media platforms like Twitter, they've become a lot more heavy-handed in, you know, if you want to put it mildly, curating the content that people see, or maybe censoring the content that people see, so that, you know, what they deem to be, you know, reputable mainstream sources or what comes up first in people's timelines, and, you know, suppressing the views of alternative media outlets, or even outlets like The Onion, for instance, which I guess is kind of an alternative news outlet. Do you think that that has something to do with this? I mean, if people are thinking of social media as like the place where they get their news, and that news source seems to be more biased now as a consequence of these reports coming out, perhaps that has something to do with the fading fortunes of Facebook and others?
It certainly does. I mean, you know, social media, in particular Facebook and Twitter, they're the new commons. They're where people go to meet others, to talk to people they know, to get information about what's going on, not just in their city, but in the world now. And we are seeing that there's been this outcry we should talk about against Twitter for supposedly censoring conservative voices. I think it's completely overblown. They rarely censor conservative voices. They often censor people of color, especially women of color, who stand up against harassment on the platform. You know, there's a big call for Jack Dorsey, the head of Twitter, to ban the Nazis who are on Twitter. It's literally a recruiting platform for white supremacists, for Nazis. And I think that's important to recognize, especially with the upcoming, Unite the Right rally that's coming up in August 12th in D.C. And I hope people will go protest against that. But, you know, these white supremacists are literally using Twitter as a platform for that. The other thing is with the algorithms that come up, especially on Facebook, you're going to see stuff that Facebook thinks you want to see. So it creates this sort of echo chamber. People are going to, you know, not see things that Facebook thinks is going to make them so angry that they just close the window. They're going to see things that Facebook thinks they're going to respond to and stay engaged, so that they see more ads on the site. And ultimately, that's what it is. It's about seeing more ads and spending more time and providing more data. So if you use the angry react against a political story, that gives Facebook some data on how you feel about that. If you get into a long flame war, Facebook thinks, okay, I'm, you know, you're passionate one way or another about this issue. And, you know, I do think it's not great that people are getting most of their information from social media, but only because of the fact that it is the social media platforms that are not transparently deciding what information we're going to see.
Chris, talk a little bit about YouTube as well. I heard over the weekend a news report that for whatever reason, YouTube's new algorithm is promoting conspiracy theories and pushing them higher up the queue. Why would they do that?
Part of it is people actually gaming the algorithm.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I hadn't thought of that, actually.
People, you know, the algorithm is only as smart as the code behind it, and people are writing that code. And, you know, whenever there's a situation like this, people will try to game the algorithm. I just read a story about how sellers on Amazon are gaming their algorithm to get more sales. It's what happens. But it's especially these right-wing and conspiracy theorist channels that are somehow, you know, getting, when you view something on YouTube, you know, it's the watch next or, you know, related videos. You could watch something on an anime series or watch something on LGBTQ rights and get presented with something, you know, a related video from like white supremacists about, you know, condemning gay people and, you know, how there's some, you know, big gay conspiracy to take over the world or something. And that's, you know, not even the worst of it. There's, you know, rabid anti-Semitism, anti-immigrant sentiment all over the place, and they are gaming the system. But the thing is, YouTube isn't doing anything about it. So YouTube and Google and Google's parent, the parent company Alphabet, aren't doing anything about it. There are some brilliant folks there who I'm sure could easily fix this, right? And they are being told, I believe, by the higher ups not to address this because they're getting views and they're getting ad hits off of these. You know, Facebook, we should say, recently limited the reach of a guy named Alex Jones, a very famous conspiracy theorist, racist, just all around awful person. But they didn't ban his account. It's, you know, his 97th or something offense, but they didn't ban his account because he gets hits. He gets hits on YouTube. He gets hits on Twitter everywhere. And so do his associates, other folks affiliated with that. So what it comes down to is it's about the money, the ad views, and the impressions.
Do those guys get paid for having videos that have like a huge number of views? I'm not 100% sure how YouTube works, but if I understand correctly, there's some sort of monetary reward for posting videos that get like very large numbers of views.
Sure, you can sign up with the YouTube Partners Program, where they determine whether or not you can have ads on your videos. I'll say I haven't watched an Alex Jones video, so I don't know if he specifically has. I just can't bring myself to do it. I don't know if he specifically has ads on his platform, but it's also driving people to YouTube, and people are watching videos on YouTube. They're clicking related links, and if those related links have, if they have ads in them, that's good for YouTube itself. So YouTube isn't just tracking how many people watch a certain video. You know, just like when you go on Amazon, right? And it says like, hey, you viewed these three products, you might like this one. They track who's going from one video to another, and how many, you know, how many people are using that certain funnel, right, to get to videos. So if Alex Jones's videos, for example, are leading people to a monetized channel, they're going to leave his videos up so people get there.
Well, makes sense. Wish I had thought of it. Maybe I'd be rich right now. Let's switch over to another issue, Chris, that's been in the news a lot today and yesterday. And that's this issue of an operation called Quiet Skies that the Federal Air Marshals, TSA, have been implementing. And what this is without any of our knowledge, Air Marshals have conducted secret in-flight monitoring of U.S. passengers. And they've been doing this for years. So they're looking for people who might be nervous or uncomfortable or are sweating or are using the restroom frequently. And that is somehow supposed to identify you as a potential terrorist. Now, of course, everybody knows that since the September 11th attacks, TSA has not found one single terrorist, while three dozen TSA agents have been arrested for stealing things out of people's luggage. So tell us a little bit about this Operation Quiet Skies and why this is so important.
Yeah, these are effectively undercover U.S. Marshals who are on planes and in airports who are watching people. We talked a few weeks ago, I believe, about at the Miami-Orlando International Airport. They were installing facial recognition. But these are actually agents since 2010, and I believe before that, because I remember a big outcry around when the Patriot Act was introduced about this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Going to, you know, who are watching people. I mean, and let's think about this, right? Being uncomfortable on a plane, how easy is it to be uncomfortable in those tiny little seats that they keep downsizing with that, you know, you don't even get a pack of peanuts anymore. You know, I certainly shift around a lot in those seats and am visibly uncomfortable because, you know, the capitalist airlines have, you know, they want to squeeze every dollar they can out of you and make you less comfortable, unless you're, you know, flying first class, but I'm sure the marshals aren't watching up there. So, they're using all of these different metrics to rate who, whether or not they think you're suspicious. They say, you know, that they're not using race as one of these, but I highly doubt that.
Yeah, I agree.
The entirety of this surveillance state, especially with these, you know, the Homeland Security programs, has been shown to target people because of race and religion. They're also just watching, you know, are your eyes shifty? Like you said, are you getting up to go to the bathroom? And so, you know, as this was revealed, the Quiet Skies program by the Boston Globe, the TSA has sort of gone on the defensive. They actually say, you know, we're no different than the cop on the corner who is placed there because of an increased possibility that something might happen. But John, as you mentioned, nothing has happened so far, right? As long as they've had this program, they have caught no one. And that there hasn't been a problem there. And also, you know, when you look into the meaning of, you know, the cop on the corner, that's also, I think it's a racial and discriminatory against poor people as well. If we look at the history and the current situation of policing in the United States.
In fact, when he was challenged, the head of TSA said, and I quote, "We are no different than the cop on the corner who is placed there because there's an increased possibility that something might happen. When you're in a tube at 30,000 feet, it makes sense to put someone there." It actually makes no sense to put someone there because there is no problem with crime when you're in a tube at 30,000 feet.
That's absolutely right. This is just about surveillance. This is about the you know, security state, creating more records and monitoring people. So the TSA does use travel records and this information that they're using by observation to identify, they say, passengers who will be subject to additional checks at airports. And so they're using these checks at the airports to, maybe you're going to go through, you know, enhanced screening, which I know people who have gone through this, and it's a deeply humiliating process to go through. I think people need to be talking about this program and really need to be addressing the government and direct surveillance of people, effectively spying on people who are taking a plane, who have bought a ticket and are taking a plane to fly somewhere. This is unleashing spies on people in the United States who are just using their right to, you know, take a plane.
You know, I want to add something to that, too. I'm looking at the Washington Post from this morning. There's an article about this program. And it says here, in 2015, the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General found that undercover agents were able to slip fake bombs past TSA screeners 95% of the time. 95% of the time. So rather than have people placed on planes to see who's sweating or who has to pee more than once, maybe they ought to worry about preventing bombs from going through the X-ray machines.
And the Washington Post article then follows up with a quote from a former TSA administrator that says, "We have a no-fail mission."
Yeah, classic.
But that certainly seems like a significant failure. The entire situation, it's security theater. It's not providing any more security. It's just looking like it does to make people think that something's happening against this threat that has been drummed up. I don't buy it.
And it kind of normalizes the whole, like,
yeah,
you know, violations of privacy, right? It's just like I don't think twice when somebody asks me to, like, take off my shoes and put my shoes through an X-ray machine. But that's kind of, I mean, that is kind of weird if you step back and think about it. Or you know, just all of the things that you have to do just to get on and off of a plane. I mean, it's kind of part of this whole psychological shift in society, right, where what's considered a violation of privacy, you know, the bar for that is a lot higher.
That's right. And fly through Europe or Asia at some point, you're not going to have to do that. And I've done it myself, and I was confused. I started taking off my shoes, and they said, no, leave your shoes on. You don't have to do that.
Right. I did the same thing. I was in Greece in April, and I took my shoes off, and they looked at me like I was crazy.
It's amazing, to Walter's point, how much we've been trained, even those who are, you know, those of us who are paying, you know, deep attention to this, how much we've been trained to sort of go along with these things. And I think it would benefit everyone to take a step back and look at what you're being asked to do or what's being done to you and say, is this necessary? Is this right? Is this a violation of your rights? What's happening, and start, you know, organizing and building to change these things.
Well, and to that point, too, and I think this is an important point that Walter raised. We only learned this year, and we learned it through the media, that TSA has a secret list of unruly passengers, a secret list, and they determine who's unruly and who's not unruly. The ACLU has complained about this. The Brennan Center for Justice at New York University has complained about it. They both say that it raises very serious constitutional issues. But then there's another fact that was in this Washington Post piece today that just made my hair stand up. It says that in September 2001, there were 16 people on the federal no-fly list. 16 people, bona fide terrorists. In 2014, there were 64,000 people on the no-fly list. And no one knows how you get on the no-fly list because it's classified. No one knows how you get off because that's classified. And in fact, even if you engage your congressman to inquire or to demand that you be removed from the no-fly list, and frankly, one of my attorneys is on the no-fly list. She has no idea why. They say that there's nothing anybody can do because it's classified, and so they're not answering to any member of Congress. And as Walter just said a moment ago, this is only going to get worse. And it's not like people haven't tried to litigate it. They have tried to litigate it over the years, and they get nowhere. And it's because of that one word, classified.
It's so easy for them to use that word, classified, national security, yep, all of that. You know, even with the no-fly list, you can be put on it because you have the same name as somebody. And then it's practically impossible, as you said, to get taken off of it. You can be put on the no-fly list because of your affiliation with somebody who may or may not be on it or who may be the subject of an investigation. You may not have done anything wrong other than somehow in their data network being affiliated with another person. And of course, they don't explain what that means. They don't explain what level of association they're looking for. on that.
Well, Chris, your tech tip for today is about Signal, and I have a few questions about the Signal application, but maybe you can just go ahead and say the tip, and then maybe we'll have a couple follow-up questions.
Absolutely. So I want to bring people's attention to how insecure text messaging is. We all send, you know, maybe dozens, hundreds of text messages a day to each other. If you send a text message, it is sent in the clear. Anyone who wants to intercept that, whether it's your phone carrier or a malicious actor who's taking over the phone network, which certainly happens, especially at political gatherings, the police can do this, can see everything you're sending via a normal text message. It gets a little better if you and your recipient have iPhones and you're using iMessage. Your text is encrypted, but you can people who want to can still see who you're sending a message to and when. So the solution to this is to use an app called Signal from a organization called Open Whisper Systems. What Signal does is it encrypts everything you send, who it's going to, when you sent it, and the content of the message itself. And the important part here is that the Signal platform doesn't keep any of that information about your message. Open Whisper Systems actually has been subpoenaed by the FBI to provide information about somebody who used Signal. And they complied with this, and they said, here's the information we have. They signed up on this date. That's all of the information they had about the person.
That's great.
That's it. So I would encourage people, use Signal as your text messaging app. Even if you think, you know, you supposedly have nothing that's really private in there, you never know what kind of information, you know, somebody could intercept. Who you're talking to. We were just talking about this association issue. They could see, you know, you don't want people to see who you're talking to or, you know, any kind of information you're sending out. Just use Signal. And the more people that use it, the better.
And what is encryption?
So encryption takes plain text. You know, I could send Walter a message. I could send you, hey, Walter, how are you doing? We still good to record today? And it takes that and it turns it into a string of just code, like gobbledygook. You wouldn't be able to read it if you saw it. But computers or our phones exchange secrets that let you actually decrypt that message. So take it and turn it from that long string of code back into that message. And there are secure ways for our phones to send each other that code and open that message so that no one else can see it. But once it's confirmed, you know, I'm talking to Walter, it sends a code that lets me, my phone, read that message the way it should have been. We use encryption every day. Every time you go to a website practically now, if it has that secure button in the top, that's encryption right there. So, it's really important to keep that stuff secure.
I want to ask you also about other encryption apps. For example, Viber, which is very popular in Europe. And what about Proton Mail? Proton Mail is based in Switzerland. It says that it's an encrypted email system, and there are two levels of encryption. Is that true? Is that a safe email system?
Proton Mail is great if you're sending email to another Proton Mail user. Unfortunately, the way email has been built, email is one of the oldest services on the internet. It is inherently not secure. So Proton Mail is great if both of you or everyone you're exchanging messages with are also using Proton Mail. In a way, it's similar to Signal, where you both have to be using the service. Unfortunately, while Signal is free, Proton Mail costs, I think, it costs a little bit of money every month, which can be a barrier for some people. In terms of other text messaging services that are, you know, encrypted text messaging services, I haven't, you know, had a chance to look at every single one, but the general theme, when you look at Telegram, when you look at WhatsApp, which is now owned by Facebook, by the way, when you look at Wire, is that the benefit Signal has is that its encryption scheme, the way it encrypts those messages so they're private, has been tested by computer scientists and privacy experts. And it's been proven to be secure in a scientific way. So that's why I recommend Signal to people.
Yeah, Signal's a great idea. I use it all the time, all the time. And there have been other people who have recommended it to me. For example, Tom Drake, who really knows his encryption business. Tom swears by Signal. And, you know, one other thing to tell our listeners about Signal, too, is that you can do phone calls through Signal. So all you do is you tap on the little icon that shows you want to send an email. And as soon as you tap on that, it gives you an option to instead make a secure phone call. And that phone call is equally encrypted. And frankly, the sound is crystal clear. It's even better than a regular cell phone call.
So there's no reason for people to use anything other than Signal, right? For phone calls and text messages.
That's right. And everyone should encourage their friends and family and everyone they know to get on it, because it can be suspicious if you're only sending Signal messages to a few people. But if you're sending them to everyone, then it doesn't look suspicious anymore, right? So the police or whoever's investigating you can say, well, you're just sending Signal stuff to these people. That's an affiliation. But if you're using Signal for all your text messaging, then they can't tell what's what.
Yeah, that's right. And another thing too is a lot of these services are based overseas. And if they're based overseas, they also can't be subpoenaed. You know, it gives you sort of that one little extra added level of safety. At least it does for me. Maybe I'm paranoid. Anyway, we're out of time. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa, who always helps us out on these technology issues on Monday. And we were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and producer of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.